Thank you for tuning in to Emmanuel Faith Community Church. We hope you enjoy today's sermon.
Well, good morning, Emmanuel Faith. So good to see you. If you're joining us online, special welcome to you also. The story goes that there was this ancient king who lived in the kind of luxury that it would be hard to imagine even in our modern world. I mean, I get it, like you've planted some pretty good gardens, but this king planted forests. You may have built a custom home, praise be to God. This king took 13 years to build his palace, and it ended up being 150 feet long, 75 feet wide, and 45 feet high. This is in the ancient world, an absolute masterpiece. I get it, you have a pet dog, great. This king had 4,000 stalls of horses for his chariots and 12,000 horsemen. I mean, he was so famous that other royalty from all over the world would come just to be in his presence to see the extravagant life that he was living. There's a story of a queen coming to visit him. She comes to his palace and she is absolutely awestruck by the clothes that his servants wear, the food that they eat, the size of his palace, so much so that the ancient account of her traveling there said that she just stood in absolute awe of the vastness of his kingdom and the opulence of his palace. Now, an article that LinkedIn did a few months ago said that if you were to have taken this king's wealth and rolled it into like modern day money, he would have been worth $2.1 trillion. So he reigned for 40 years, and each year he got 25 tons of gold. So if you were to rank the modern GDP of all the countries in the world, this king all by himself would be ranked number 11 in the world. Just for a little bit of context, the richest person alive today, his name is Bernard Arnault, and he is currently worth $215 billion, or should I say a measly $215 billion. This king was 10 times richer than the richest person in the world today. Any ideas what his name was? King Solomon. And he gets to the top of the proverbial mountain, and he looks at everything that he's accumulated and all of the food that he's consumed and the things that he's built and the women that he's married, and he looks at all of it. And this is his conclusion about everything that he has. Vanity of vanities, says the preacher. Vanity of vanities. Let's just say these three words together. All is vanity. Wait. What? Like, Solomon, run that back for us. Like, you have the best food. You live in the laps of luxury. You're being served day and night, and it's all empty? That's what that word vanity means. Meaningless? I mean, here's the deal, you guys. Solomon had everything we assume would make us happy. He had everything we assume. If I just had a little bit more, if I had enough of that, then I would be enough. Then I would feel like I have enough. Then I would feel like I've arrived. Then that like empty void inside of me would finally be filled, and I'd finally be fulfilled. And Solomon gets everything you think you need to be happy, and he says it's not enough. Actually, it's all empty. Years later, a comedian and actor, Jim Carrey, would say the same thing. He said, I wish everybody could get rich and famous and have everything they ever dreamed of so that they would know it's not the answer. That's quite the statement. He's saying the only reason that you think you might one day have enough to satisfy your soul is because there's a little bit more out there. And he says, nope, I've been there. More is not the answer. Bigger is not the answer. Brighter, newer, better is not the answer. And maybe, just maybe, we're all climbing the wrong ladder only to realize that when we get to the top, it was leaning against the wrong building the entire time. See, as a pastor, one of my great honors is being invited into the deep recesses of people's hearts and minds and souls. And I am just amazed at the loneliness and the sadness that often lies behind all of the successes and all of the accolades and all of the accomplishments. See, I think that apart from God, there is a latent sense of emptiness in every single one of us. And I don't think anybody outruns or escapes or achieves their way out of that feeling. I think apart from God, we walk through this life humming, I can't get no satisfaction. Or, if you want to have a little bit of a better band, maybe you sing, I still haven't found what I'm looking for. And we echo the ache. We echo that ache. We call it yearning. We call it thirst. We call it wanting. We call it hunger. We call it sadness. We call it emptiness. But there is a void inside of every single one of us that we are looking for a way to fill. And apart from God, we will never fill it like we need to. So, if you've ever thought that you had everything you wanted and still found yourself wanting, this message is for you. If you have believed the lie that just a little bit more will satisfy, this message is for you. If you've ever lied awake at night staring at the ceiling with that existential angst just haunting your soul thinking there's got to be more to life than this, this message is for you. So if you have your Bible, would you open it up to John chapter 21? Can you believe that next week we will finish our series in the Gospel of John? It will happen, friends, Lord willing. And yeah, let's just run it back. Let's do it again. I've just loved diving into this book with you. I hope that you have too. As we're finishing out this series in John, we're in a series that we're calling Back to Life, where we're looking at Jesus' resurrection and then three accounts that he has with his disciples after his resurrection. This is the third, and we're breaking it into two parts. Listen to the way that it begins. This is after Jesus has been raised from the dead. It says this. And after this, Jesus revealed himself again to the disciples by the Sea of Tiberias, which is also the Sea of Galilee. And he, would you say those two words with me? Revealed himself in this way. Now, if you were an author in the ancient world, one of the things you would do in order to make a point is repeat yourself. What word does John repeat? Revealed, right. He doesn't want you to miss that this is a story about what happens when Jesus shows up. We already saw Jesus insert himself into the disciples' fear. We saw Jesus insert himself into the disciples' doubt. Today, we're going to see Jesus insert himself into their emptiness. Simon Peter, Thomas called the twin, Nathanael of Cana in Galilee, the sons of Zebedee, and two other disciples were together. And Simon Peter said to them, I am going fishing. And they said, we will go with you, which, by the way, is really good because they were fishing with nets, not poles, and it's really, really hard to fish with a net all alone. Peter's still the leader of the disciples. He says it, and the disciples are like, we're with you, man. And they went out and they got into the boat, but that night they caught how much?
Nothing.
Nothing. They are worn out and they are empty-handed. They worked their hands to the bone and had absolutely nothing to show for it. Anybody been there? Anybody, where you were like putting out your best effort, but it just didn't seem like it was enough? Like you feel like you are investing in the marriage and it doesn't seem like it's moving forward, or you feel like you have worked your tail off and you have saved as much as you can, but the finances just aren't enough to make ends meet? Or maybe you feel like, I've been going to church, I've been praying, I've been reading my Bible, and chasing after God just sort of seems like I'm chasing after a shadow. Has anyone been there? Where you've just been putting down the nets and pulling them up and there is nothing to show for your hard work. Good news. I am beginning to be more and more convinced, and this is sort of a personal journey for me also, that coming to terms with our own personal insufficiency and inadequacy is the very starting point of the genuine spiritual journey. It's the very place that we encounter God. So let me remind you that Jesus came for the sick, not the well. That Jesus came for the weak, not for the strong. That Jesus came for the unrighteous, not for the righteous. That Jesus came for the empty, not for the full. And that emptiness is the very place of encounter. It becomes the place of encounter. See, I've spent a lot of my life believing that if I worked just a little bit harder, I could fill that void. If I accomplished just a little bit more, then I would feel like I was okay. I've fished a lot of nights, came up empty-handed, and in the back of my mind believed I just need to fish a little bit harder. Which, by the way, how do you fish harder? Or like, come on, like, boys, like, pull it up harder. And I think it's a great metaphor for life. Because just working harder hardly ever works. That's a word for someone in here today, me, and maybe you also, that just working harder hardly ever works. But praise be to God that from the very first pages of Scripture, we see God creating out of emptiness. The earth was formless and void, and God creates. We see a God who takes the nation of Israel into the wilderness, a place of emptiness, in order to help them become a nation. We see a God who over and over again takes barren wombs and creates life out of them. Or even, you may have heard this one, even brings life out of a virgin's womb. Like, this is a God who consistently, over and over again, uses emptiness as his canvas to create abundance. So what if he wants to do the same thing in your life and in my life today? That's where the disciples were. It says, and just as, verse 4, just as day was breaking, Jesus stood on the shore. Now, just a quick time out. John's a poet, right? And so he's telling us, and I think if this were a movie, like the score would get dramatic. It would slow down. And you would see Jesus standing silhouetted on the Sea of Galilee shore, and behind him the sun would be rising, because John wants you to see not only that the light of this day is coming, but the light of the world is showing up. Jesus stood on the shore, and yet the disciples did not know it was Jesus. And Jesus said to them, children, hey boys, do you have any fish? Question, does Jesus know the answer to that question? Absolutely, yes, he does. It's sort of like when your dentist looks in your mouth and asks you, have you been flossing? My line back to him is always, Doc, I think we both know the answer to that question, don't we? And don't floss shame me. Don't you dare. Don't you. So they answered him, no, we don't. We got no fish. And he said to them, cast the net on the right side of the boat and you will find some. So they cast it, and now they were not able to haul it in because of the quantity of fish. And we'll go back and dive into the details, but I want to zoom out so you can see the story arc. The disciples have fished all night. They are exhausted. They have caught nothing. Jesus is revealed. Jesus speaks a word. They listen to Jesus, and then their nets are overflowing. This is a story about working hard and having nothing to show for it and going to having your nets absolutely full. This is a story about God's favor and blessing in your life, a God who wants your life to overflow with good. This is a story about having fullness pierce your emptiness, because encounter with Jesus is the only thing that can satisfy our emptiness. And I'm not sure what kind of emptiness resides in you, but maybe it would be good for us to just take a moment to name that there's probably something in each one of us, in like the dark corners of our heart that we're holding back from God, and thinking, if I just dropped a few more nets and worked a little bit harder and maybe went out again and just tried it on my own, like then I could be satisfied. And it might be good for you to just name whatever that is in your life right now. It might be something that you're wrestling with. It might be a prayer that you've just been praying over and over again, but you can't seem to quite let go in order to let God take the reins. It might be a relationship that's off the rails. Forgiveness that you just can't offer. But it would be really good for us to name that emptiness and then to just sit with the conviction that with one word, Jesus can fill. And he alone can do it. Now, there's a part that we get to play in this too, and I want to point that out to you. There's four things that the disciples do to partner with Jesus as he moves them from empty to abundant. So let's go back and let's look at the details. So Jesus says to them, hey boys, did you catch anything? And they're like, no, we caught nothing. And then Jesus says, hey, why don't you try the other side of the boat? Which is really interesting. I'm not sure if you know how boats work. But they float on top of the water. And sometimes they even turn on the water. So like the left can be the right and the right can be the left. And I don't know if you've ever realized this, but there's like no right-left compartment underneath your boat. Like the fish go back and forth. There's no wall separating them. Like, hey, what's the secret passcode to get from the right side of the boat to the left side? No, like if you've never been under a boat, here's what it looks like. And the fish are sort of like going back and forth, back and forth. And I say all of this just to say that this command is absolutely ridiculous. The boat is 7.5 feet wide. Not a lot of difference underneath between the left side of the boat and the right side of the boat. And I think what Jesus would say to us today is if you want to move from empty to abundant, then you have to have a posture of unconditional obedience. I'm challenged with this because I want to say to Jesus what I just said to you. Hey, Lord, that doesn't make any sense. Like if you could explain it in a scientific way and the neuroscience behind this, blah, 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 then I'd be with you. And so really my obedience is conditioned based on my understanding, not what he's asking. We see this from the very beginning. The disciples, the very first time they encounter Jesus, they're on the same sea. They fished all night. They've caught nothing. They're repairing their nets so that they can go back out the next night in order to fish. He comes up to them on the side of the same shore and he says, hey guys, let's go back out and let's fish some more. And they're like, oh, come on. You got to be kidding me. Like we just caught nothing in the best part of the night. And what are we going to catch in the middle of the day? He asks them to do the ridiculous from the very word go. And do you know what they say back to him? If you say so. Like, we don't get it, but if you say so. I've started to wonder how many commands of Jesus I have reasoned my way out of following. They don't deserve my forgiveness. Let go of my anger. My anger is a righteous anger. Thank you very much. Something in the Bible about that. Right? Like how many times has Jesus prompted you and you have reasoned your way out of it? Let me remind me and you, there's a way that appears to be right, but in the end leads to what? Death. See, you have to come to the place where you realize or you have this conviction that your way of thinking about life is deeply flawed. Deeply flawed. And it's only then that you give Jesus the blank check of yes. I will say yes regardless of what you ask me to do because I believe that you are good and I believe that you are right. Throw my nets down on the right side of the boat even though there's no compartment of right left underneath where the fish are? Yes. Forgive them? Yes. Love my enemies? Pray for those who persecute me? Yes. Because you said so. Yes. Man, that's a different way of reading the Bible, you guys. I love the way that Eugene Peterson put it when he said this. He said, the most important question isn't, what does this mean? But what can I obey? That's a great line, because so much of the time we go to scripture saying, what does this mean? And that's a great question. We should try to figure out what it means, but let's not allow the desire to figure out what it means to cloud our conviction that what it says we are called to do. Simple obedience, Eugene writes, will open up our lives to a text more quickly than any number of Bible studies, dictionaries, and concordances. You want the scriptures to come alive? Say yes. You want your life to come alive? Say yes. And it doesn't have to be in these like extravagant ways. Like saying yes doesn't mean like we're gonna put you on a boat and send you to another country necessarily. It might. But it doesn't need to mean that. It might just mean you go to work tomorrow with a new sense of purpose of why you're there. Yes. I love this story of Patty, who serves on our worship team, that we shared yesterday at our Love Your Neighbor conference. And I just wanted you to see it because I think it paints a great picture of what it might look like to say yes.
Hi, my name is Patty Tamayo. When I first started off my career, I was working for chiropractors and doctors, and people would get in car accidents, they'd see them, they'd come see me. So I was very interested in the medical aspect of massage. But doing this for 17 years, I've learned that it's very important, emotional and physical part go together. They go hand in hand. Women would come to me with physical ailments and I would help them with that. A lot of the times their depression would exacerbate those symptoms. So I went ahead and got certified in lay counseling and life coach certifications so I could have more tools to help these women. And it's just been an honor to be able to pray over them and talk through problems and see their lives thrive physically, emotionally, and mentally after working with them for a period of time. Well, as I work on people, I have developed these really beautiful friendships. I've learned that when I hear God speak, most of the time when I ask if I can pray over them, it's just very humbling, you know? Because I never thought that this career would lead to ministry moments like that, so it's been really sweet. It's been really just a beautiful career. I love it.
I love that because there's a few things that I loved about it. Number one, it's in the rhythm of Patty's everyday. Mm-hmm. Number two, she's saying yes, and then, oh, maybe there's some training and there's some tools that I could get, and then she's saying yes, and maybe I could start praying for my clients and just taking my faith and conviction about the gospel into my everyday life. Yes, yes, yes. So my question is, what does your yes look like? What does your yes look like? Maybe it looks like some form of confession or repentance. Maybe it looks like starting to deal with your stuff. Maybe it looks like admitting that you are in need. Maybe it just means saying, I'm gonna live today like I really believe that Jesus walked out of the grave. What does that look like for you? Because there is abundance on the other side of your obedience. There's abundance on the other side of your obedience. And if there is a step of obedience that you're resisting, there is a blessing that you are forfeiting. Your yes is the key that unlocks your readiness to receive God's sufficiency. So the disciples say yes to this crazy invitation from Jesus. And then look at what happens next. The disciple whom Jesus loved, which by the way is John, the author, and he just wants to point out again, Jesus loves me. I said this before, but let's just imagine the other disciples reading his account, and he's like, he loved us all, man. Like, and therefore, he said to Peter, it is the Lord. So John's like, hey, I just want to record that I'm the one who noticed Jesus. I told Peter, it is the Lord. And when Simon Peter heard that it was the Lord, he put on his outer garment, for he was stripped for work, and threw himself into the sea. Remember that time that you were going to go swimming and you got on your coat right before you jumped in the water? Said no one ever? Right, this is a picture of Peter responding to Jesus in a way that can only be described as passionate pursuit. Like, he is just all in. Peter doesn't shrink back. Peter doesn't play it cool at all. Peter doesn't wallow in his shame of, man, I betrayed Jesus, and now am I allowed to even go out? No, like, he is, give me that coat, I'm putting it on, and I am swimming to shore. He dives in, swims his heart out, gets to shore soaking wet, because that's where Jesus is. He exhibits this hunger, this passion that the Lord brought to mind Psalm 63 and David's psalm about his passion for God. You, God, are my God, and earnestly I seek you. I thirst for you. My whole being longs for you in a dry and parched land where there is no water. If this were a love sonnet, we would blush when we read it. But David's like, I long for you with that kind of devotion and affection. He'll say in verse 5 of the same psalm, I will be fully satisfied. Fully satisfied. As with the richest of foods, with singing lips, my mouth will praise you. Like, what if we started to look at our relationship with God in that same way? What if we started to view coming together for worship in the same way? Like, your friends ask you, where are you going and what are you doing? I'm going so that my soul would be satisfied. I'm going to feast on the God who is the only one who is enough. I'm going so that the rhythms of my life would come into alignment with my Creator's design, so that I might know his sufficiency and his abundance in ways I never knew before. That's what we're doing here, you guys. But I want you to see that there's a progression here, and it's really important, because I think sometimes, at least for me, I stop short of what Jesus is inviting me to. Here's the progression. Number one, revelation. You can read about that in verse 1. Jesus reveals himself to the disciples. Step number 2. Pursuit. Peter puts on all of his clothes and then swims to Jesus. Like, he's like, I am going after Jesus with everything I have. Third, encounter. Encounter. That's the way things work for us too. And here's my, I just want you to think about this, because what I've realized is that I oftentimes mistake revelation for encounter. I stop at revelation. I'm reading the scriptures, Spirit will point something out to me, and I'm like, Lord, thank you. That's really, really good. And I sort of leave it there. I wonder if maybe you do too. Like, what would it look like to pursue harder, to push further, to believe that God gives us revelation so that we pursue, and then we end up on the beach, maybe soaking wet, but right in front of Jesus? So the other day, I was at Trader Joe's, and I walked in the door, and there was this woman there holding a tray that had these little samples of spicy mango lemonade on them. Praise be to God. I took that, like, half-ounce drink, and the Shekinah glory of the Lord filled Trader Joe's. And here's what I did not do. I did not go, praise be to God, and walk out the door. I went, I have got to find the sweet nectar of life. And I went back to where they keep the drinks, and it wasn't there. And I found an attendant, and I'm like, where is the nectar of the gods? And they're like, what do you mean? The spicy mango lemonade. They're like, oh, it's in the cold fridge up near the flowers. I'm like, done. I am there. I went and got that 32 ounces of goodness, and I can tell you that the rest of it was just as good as the first sip. But praise the Lord, I didn't stop with the 0.5 ounces they gave me in the store. I think too many of us stop with the 0.5 ounces of revelation, and we don't keep pushing. There's more, you guys. There is more that Jesus wants to show you. There's more that he wants to reveal to you. Allow the revelation to cause you to pursue so that you might encounter and hear his voice on deeper and deeper levels. I'm reminded of what the Apostle Paul wrote to the church in Corinth, and he said, we all. So if you're like, hey, Ryan, that's for special Christians. I just want to speak into that lie. It's for you. And we, with unveiled face, beholding the glory of the Lord, are being transformed into the same degree of glory, from one degree of glory to another. For this comes from the Lord who is Spirit. See, we behold, and that is the place that we become, but we have to allow revelation to drive us to pursuit that eventually will end in encounter. And I'm convinced, you guys, that it won't happen by accident. It will not happen by accident. Like our attachment to our phones, our constant need for entertainment, our unwillingness to rest and be silent so often blocks us from chasing revelation to pursuit that will end with encounter. Reminded of what John Ortberg wrote when he said, you must arrange your day so that you are experiencing deep contentment, joy, and confidence in your everyday life with God. So it might mean that you wake up a little bit earlier to seek him through the scriptures. It might mean that you sit a little bit longer in silence to hear his voice. It might mean that you fast and create hunger that you anticipate Jesus filling. It might mean that you give generously so that you can then encounter his provision. But it probably won't happen if you just keep doing what you're doing. There is an encounter waiting on the other side of your pursuit, and it's worth it. It's worth it. Verse 8, the other disciples came in the boat. Don't you just imagine they're dragging these nets, and they're like, gosh, it'd be nice to have another set of hands here. Peter. Dragging the nets full of fish, for they're not far from the land, about 100 yards off, which, by the way, is a pretty long way to swim fully clothed. When they got on the land, they saw a charcoal fire in place with fish laid out on it and bread. And Jesus said to them, bring some of the fish that you just caught. So Simon Peter, who didn't help bring the fish in, went aboard and hauled in the net ashore. I'll take it from here, boys, right? Full of large fish, 153 of them, and altogether there were so many. The net was not torn. Now, a lot of people get held up on 153. What does that mean? If anybody tells you they know what that means, they're lying. There's hypotheses about it, but nobody really knows. It's a number of completeness. It's a large number of fish, as John states. What's more interesting to me is that the first time that Jesus encounters these disciples on the same lake and does the same thing, their nets get so full that they broke. But here they are, roughly 3 years later, with a massive haul of fish, and their nets don't break. It's like walking with Jesus for 3 years increased their capacity to receive and host and carry his favor and blessing. But notice that Jesus says to them, bring me some of those fish. And they don't say, hey, we worked really hard to catch those fish. Hey, those are our fish, Jesus. You go catch your own fish. Why don't you cook those? No, what do? They say, yes. See, there's this posture of willing surrender that's part of moving from empty to abundant. See, we see a call to obedience, a call to passionate pursuit, but then a willingness to say, Jesus, whatever is in my hands, you can have. Which is often counterintuitive. We think if we're going to move towards abundance, we've got to protect what we have. And Jesus says, it's just the opposite. You want to move from empty to abundant, surrender what you have. Give it to the Lord, and he will multiply it. See, Jesus often asks us for the things that we would rather protect and preserve than hand over. My friend and one of our worship leaders, Jean, she's working with her young son. His name is Jojo, and they live in this place where he's able to capture all sorts of critters, right, like lizards and frogs, and he loves bringing them inside, and he creates little houses for them that he hides from his parents, Jean and Lewis, and so that he can keep them as pets, right? And he wants to keep them, and he wants to enjoy them. And so they'll find these little shoeboxes with lizards or frogs in them and try to teach their young son, hey, if you want to keep this alive, you're going to have to release it. And I think Jesus wants to say the same thing to us. Those things that you want to protect, those things that you want to preserve, those things that you want to hold on to so tightly, if you want them to live, you have got to release them. And by the way, you are releasing them to the one who gave them to you in the first place. Like, the disciples have to be well aware at this point, the only reason they have a net full of fish is because of Jesus. They are no longer under the illusion. We worked hard for this. We earned this. We did this. All of that illusion is stripped away. Jesus provided it. And I would say that about everything that's in my life and everything that's in your life. If you have it, Jesus provided it. So what does your willing surrender look like today? Here's the last portion. It says this, verse 12. So Jesus says to them, come and have breakfast. And none of the disciples dared ask him, who are you? They knew it was the Lord. And Jesus came and took bread and gave it to them, and so with the fish. It's really interesting to me that the risen Christ is seen a number of different times feeding people. It's almost as though he wants them to know that they will feed not just on his death, but that they will also feed on his life. He wants them to know, I am the good shepherd. And I want to lead you to streams of living water. And I want to feed you. And I want to lead you into the green pasture so that your soul is satisfied. And the disciples' posture is simply one of joyful, hands open, hearts open reception. But if I'm honest, I've got at least two issues with that. Here's the first. If he's the host and he's the chef and he's the one serving my soul, I don't get to decide when he feeds me. And can I be honest? Sometimes I don't think he knows or cares how hungry I am. I'm like, Lord, now. Now would be a good time to satisfy this desire. You are the king of abundance. You own a cattle on a thousand hills. Now would be really good. But I just want you to know that the good shepherd and the divine chef works on his timeline, not yours. We get to keep our hearts and our hands open, believing that he will provide and that he will satisfy. And when he does it, only he knows best. So I don't get to decide when he feeds me, and I also don't get to decide what he feeds me. And I'm quite convinced that there are things that Jesus is feeding me that are becoming, shall I say, an acquired taste. Anybody want to, you with me on this? Like, things that you didn't like at first that you find yourself going, oh, Brussels sprouts. You roast them and put enough glaze on, balsamic glaze on them, they're okay. I mean, things like patience, right? Things like God building character and hope through perseverance in suffering. Like, man, he's making me eat my spiritual vegetables, and I know it's good for me. But there are some times where I would like to say, hey, God, can we talk about what I'm eating here? Because I'm not sure I love it. So a few weeks ago, Kelly, my wife Kelly and I, We were out at this steakhouse just celebrating some things that God had done in our life. And we ordered, and Kelly ordered a 6-ounce steak, and I ordered a 16-ounce steak. Don't judge me. I don't know why you're laughing. So we're talking, and then the server brings the steaks out, and they brought us 2 6-ounce steaks. And I look at my steak, and I look at Kelly's steak, and I'm like, these steaks look the same size to me. And our servers are like, yeah, they're both 6-ounce steaks. And I'm like, that's the size of like a silver dollar, maybe. And I'm like, oh, I ordered the 16-ounce steak. And she's like, oh, what do you want me to do? True story. And I'm like, make this steak 3 times its size. That's what I want you to do. So not wanting to be a jerk, I say back to her, well, what do you think we should do? And I'm like, I'm looking at Kelly like, how are you judging me here? Because this is an appetizer. And I say to Kelly, like, are you okay if we wait a few more minutes? And she's like, yeah, absolutely. I said, then what I would like you to do is bring me the steak that I ordered. The biggest 16-ounce one you can find back there, preferably. And I was struck by the fact that I got this sense in studying this passage that there are so many times Jesus serves me up something. I want to send it back to the kitchen. Like, I don't know if I signed up for that one, Lord. I'm not sure if I like the way that one tastes. I didn't order that on the menu. Is there anything in your life that you're looking at and going, Lord, I didn't order that one. I'm not sure I like that one. I'm not sure what to do with it. Can you just take it back? What if you believed that the chef and the server was also the good shepherd of your soul? What if you believed that that divine host loved you more than anyone you will lay eyes on this side of heaven? What if you believed that he had your good and your joy in mind every time he shows up at your table? What if you believed that? Would that change anything? So here the disciples are in the middle of this lake. After fishing all night, they're frustrated. They have absolutely nothing to show for it. They're empty-handed. They are worn out. And then Jesus. And then Jesus shows up with an absolutely ridiculous word that leads to their favor and his grace and his love being poured out. Friends, this is the journey that he's inviting each one of us on. One where we say yes before we even know what the question is. If you're asking, I'm in. I don't have to get it to obey. One where we say, I'm gonna chase after you, Lord. I'm gonna allow the revelation to drive me to pursue so that I can encounter. I don't want to settle for the appetizer at the door. I want the feast and the banquet that you've prepared. I want it all. Further up, further in. I want it all, Lord. Everything that you want to give me, I want it. And then, God, I'm willing to give you everything that's in my hands because I believe that you are better at taking care of it than I am. And whatever you want to give back to me to pour into my life, I will do my best to joyfully receive it because I believe that you are a God who wants to move me from empty to abundant. So what are the empty nets in your life? What are the wilderness voids that you sense in your soul that Jesus today wants to speak a better word over? This was the third time Jesus was what? Revealed to the disciples after he was raised from the dead. And since Jesus is alive, we can live fully satisfied. So can we be so bold today as to name our emptiness? I don't want to end my life like Solomon, realizing that I've been climbing the wrong mountain and the wrong ladder the whole time. The risen Christ wants to come to you, just like he did to those disciples, and say, cast your nets down on the other side. There is abundance waiting to fill your emptiness. So let's just pause, and I just want to create space. For the Spirit of God to work, what's the yes he's asking? What's the chase that he's inviting you to follow him into that you might passionately pursue? What's the surrender and what's the reception? Would you just ask the Lord? And then, Holy Spirit, would you speak?
Thank you for listening to our service. We'd love to have you join us in person. For more information about our church and service times, please visit efcc.org. If you would like to support the ministries of Emmanuel Faith, you can do so at efcc.org/give.